Explore the night skies with our large range of high-quality telescopes. Whether you're a novice or an astronomy expert, we have the right telescope for you in our Australian Geographic e-store. Explore the whole range and find the right telescope for you today. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/shop. That's australiangeographic.com.au/shop. G'day, I'm Liz Guinness, and welcome to Talking Australia. Today I'm joined by Ian Morris, who's a teacher, biologist, conservationist, author, and all-round incredible human being. Ian has spent the past 50-odd years living and working in East Arnhem Land, and as you'll hear today, his passion for culture and people there is palpable. So join me today as Ian reveals the many gifts of this remarkable region of Australia. Trust me, you're not going to want to miss a second. And welcome back to part two of our conversation with Ian Morris.
Here's the question, Ian, the million-dollar question. How do we get our national parks authorities to take on board these traditional ways? How do we manage that?
Well, I think our national parks, federal and state legislations, are out of date, and I think they need to be really rewritten, reanalyzed, and rewritten to bring them up to the time. Now, see, we've got animals in national parks that are disappearing, going extinct, but nobody can go near them, you can't enter from the outside and help or do anything. So the message is not going into our classrooms. Our kids are not learning the meaning of our natural systems and how to manage them. We really need to analyse our whole society again now, and also have a darn good look at what remains of the traditional management systems that were in place when we got here. It's almost a cultural arrogance we've suffered from. And we need to readdress that. So there are lots of ways. I mean, I go in and out of classrooms all the time talking about these things with the kids. You can actually see it all around you, and you can go out. A lot of it's just common sense. But our, as I said, our legislation stops us from interacting with native animals. We're not allowed to take them home as pets or anything like that. We're kind of divorced from the natural systems, and so society doesn't see it as very important these days like we should. So I think we've really got to have a pretty big look at the whole system. Some of our NGOs, Australian Conservation Foundation, people like that, they're doing really good jobs. They're doing it properly, but they're doing it privately. I think we could do it nationally if we put our hearts to it. And I think we've got to start with our education systems. I don't think we're teaching environmental education anywhere near the level that we should be. To show the kids the importance of it all. As you said earlier, we live here, we've got to live in this place, and the quality of life where we live depends on how we manage our environment. So, I think it'd be a great thing if we reanalyse the whole system today.
And so when you say you go into schools, obviously you're in Indigenous schools, but are you going into schools in Darwin, for instance, with, children who don't traditionally have this information passed on to them through their parents?
Yes, I do, all the time. In fact, I go into mainstream schools more these days than the Indigenous schools, but with that message. And often I'll go in with an Indigenous friend and we'll do a sort of a joint approach or something like that. But I also have a bush camp outside Darwin where school groups come and stay, and we do a lot of that, and I often will go and get one of my old Indigenous aunties to come down and be our lecturer for the day and take the class through the bush and show them the economic plants that are growing all around us that we don't recognise, and get the kids back into enjoying the natural landscape.
Well, I think that's it, isn't it? Once they connect with it, once they see it, once they touch it, once they, they smell it, it comes to life for them, as opposed to sitting in a classroom and just hearing about it.
Most definitely. And kids are really sensitive to that sort of thing. They have an experience with an animal. The other day we had a group of people and we came across a Nephila spider, a golden orb spider, great big spider the size of my hand. And I was able to just very gently take this big female Nephila spider off her golden orb web and put her on my shirt, and she walked around on me for a while, and then the kids got brave and they all started holding and letting the spider climb over their back and seeing that in nature, if there's no fear in the equation, then you get a really amazing experience. And these spiders are quite friendly anyway, they're scary looking things. But that was a good example to the kids that if you have the right attitude when you're out in the bush, you're not afraid of what might happen to you, but you're fascinated by what's around you, then your experience is very different, very positive.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. So it just sounds like there's so much to we can all learn, I'm sure most of our listeners would love to come and spend some time in Arnhem Land listening to you and walking through the bush with you. So these cruises that you do, that's an opportunity for people to join in and learn that sort of stuff?
Yes, definitely. When I was young and living out in the communities in the bush, I used to think that tourism would come in and kill everything. I think the reverse today. I've dealt with thousands of ordinary Aussie people who've come on these expeditions, we call them, along the coastline.
Yep.
And then we're able to introduce them to all these things, the people themselves, the environment, the unique wildlife. And going out at night, you know, looking at crocodiles doing their own thing and being natural and not scary, but fascinating. And so I really have enjoyed this. And not only that, it's brought lots of people, ordinary Aussies, into a whole new awareness and have made new friends. You know, today, you know, when you meet Indigenous people, you can exchange phone numbers and emails and things like that and carry on a friendship even remotely. And it's also brought quite a bit of money into these little bush communities that are otherwise welfare dependent. Our government has really set up our Indigenous communities now with control over them, and it's very, very difficult for them to actually earn a living in a true sense of the word. Whereas when these people come in, they want to interact with the people, they want to buy their arts and crafts and take back memories and actually hear them telling their own stories face-to-face about life in general. And there's a real hunger for this in Australian society today. And as I said, I've dealt with thousands and thousands of Aussies doing this now over the last 20 years. And it really excites me to think that the two sides can now appreciate each other in a proper way. And, I'm looking forward to doing more of this sort of work on a bigger scale if I can.
Oh, absolutely. Look, it sounds incredible. As I imagine many of the people listening are completely envious that you get to spend so much time up there in that incredible part of Australia. So for people who, say, for instance, didn't want to take an expedition cruise, is there another way that it's accessible to them?
Yes, up here in the north now, most communities, I'm just thinking of places like Mowanjum in the Kimberley, where the national highway right around Australia goes right past the little community of Mowanjum on the Gibb River Road. They have a wonderful art centre there. The federal government helped them to build it, and they've been able to pay it off, and they now own it. And it displays the traditions of the Kimberley, because people in the Mowanjum community actually come from all different clan groups all over the Kimberley region. And now they're able to kind of show the rest of the world who they are without getting their country wrecked. They don't need, you know, hotels and double buses and things like that. People can actually meet them on their own terms. And then from Mowanjum, people can then, once they're sensitised, can go out into the more remote areas of the Kimberley and really appreciate what they're looking at, the art sites and so on. So today I see the beginnings of some really, really good ways of introducing our non-Indigenous population, the bulk of us, to these wonderful Indigenous people who managed this country for so long. Same with Arnhem Land now. You can take tours which sensitise you to the people and the place across central Arnhem Land and way up to the little community of Nhulunbuy, You can visit wonderful art centres along the way. Yirrkala, northeast Arnhem Land, they have an art centre there, Bukwalarangay Arts and Crafts Centre. It's world class, and the artwork in there is absolutely stunning. Well, you as a tourist can catch a bus up to that area, a tour bus, or you can drive, you get a permit and drive up there. And I think what's happening now is people are more excited about who these people were and are and where it's all going and how they can help in a sort of a positive way. So tourism is actually done the right way is beneficial and doing good things today, and I'm happy to be a part of that.
Well, I guess that was one of my questions, is how do we best support Indigenous communities? It's through buying the art and craft and I guess being a sensitive, sustainable tourist, yeah?
Yeah. The Aboriginal people are very interpersonal. They like making friends. And I say to these travellers who come with me, you know, if you buy some of their arts and crafts, for you, you're taking away a wonderful little souvenir that you can put in your house or give to your grandchildren. But to these people, you're saying, we like you. If you buy their arts and crafts, it's a step into their world, and it's a positive thing. They like it. So I say to my tourists, you know, here's a great way to spend your holiday pay. Leave it behind in a community that really needs the capital from it. But also you're saying to them, you know, we like who you are and what you do. And so I think there's a whole new interface coming up in the future.
So just, you know, moving forward in the next 5 to 10 years, how important do you think people like you are and the things that you do and environmental consultants are going to be in terms of, I guess, bridging a gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous culture and knowledge?
Well, I've been amazed at, as I said earlier, the way in which people embrace this today. We get a boatload of 100 passengers in Cairns, and we sail around the coastline of North Australia to Darwin and Broome. And the level of enthusiasm about learning about Indigenous Australians and how they managed this continent in pre-European times, it just increases as you go along the coast. And by the time you get where you're going, people are hungry for more information on the Indigenous people, their languages, their history, and we really enjoy going ashore and meeting groups in different places. And so places like Maningrida and Goulburn Island got little groups. They all speak different languages. They all have different histories. And a lot of that it comes out in their arts and their crafts. And when you're there with those people, they're telling you a little bit about who they are through their artwork and their craftwork. They're manifesting
their... Doing a little piece of themselves.
Really, yeah, it's kind of nice. And you go away thinking, this is not just retail, it's not just us buying something off of another bunch of people. It's two cultures kind of starting to merge, and it's really exciting stuff. So I'm encouraged by the way Australians are starting to do this. It's not cheap to do these trips, but it is amazing value for money if you've got that money to do it. And I really encourage people, if they've got the spare money, that's a great way to use it up.
I often feel like when you take a trip like that, I was fortunate enough to go to Papua New Guinea and spend some time in some of the villages, remote villages there. And it's like they give a piece and you leave a piece of yourself with those people. And those interactions change you, I think, always for the better and often for life. Your viewpoint, I imagine it would be
definitely
similar heading into them, into those communities.
One thing that struck me when I was young was that I was raised as a little boy in Sydney, and I was told that if I was a good boy and towed the line and behaved myself in school and learnt my lessons well, that I'd be able to grow up and get a bank account and buy a house and a car and get married and have three children. And all these values that I was being taught were quite different to what I was being taught in Arnhem Land with the Aboriginal families who looked after me. And I realised that I was being raised to be an individual, to stand on my own two feet in modern Western society. And that took me away from who these people really are. And they're the opposite. They were being, their kids my age in Arnhem Land were being raised to realise that you're part of a clan group, and you've proudly looked after this land for a long, long time. And if you're a good person, male or female, didn't matter. If you're a good person and did the right things that your clan demanded of you, then the world was a better place, and you're helping everybody else around you. So there was these two different philosophies, and I started to identify more with the Arnhem Land Aboriginal philosophy than I did with my own one in Sydney. And I realised that if I had their attitude to life, I would be a lot closer to people. I'd be keen to meet a lot more people and share and that sort of thing, rather than to be an isolated individual in a complex society. So I'm really grateful that I had that experience early in life, and it's really affected how I interact with other people now. And of course, the product that I want to sell, just like the Indigenous people, is love for the land and empathy with our land. We don't have empathy. We take photos. We kind of like it from a distance, you know, but we're not part of it. Whereas Aboriginal people are part of this country, Australia, and that's how they feel. And I can identify with that now. And I would like more non-Indigenous people to appreciate that fact.
We'll be back with our conversation after this. We have a special offer for all our listeners. Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $30 and save 33% on the newsstand price. That's three issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $30. Plus, you'll also receive exclusive benefits, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia for our special offer. That's australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia.
Ian, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today. And as I said, I feel your passion dripping from every word, which is, you know, wonderful. And I'm sure all our listeners will feel it too. Speaking of our listeners and our readers, we reached out on Instagram and asked people what they wanted to know from you. So if you've got a couple of minutes, we might just run through a few of them.
Yep.
Okay, so M. Reedy said, how do environmental professionals educate themselves better on Indigenous heritage?
Well, those that do that, I'm sure if you are working in any particular area or want to work in a particular area, I think the first thing to do would be, like their own courtesy, they will go and see the landowner and start from there. So if you're going to work anywhere where there are Indigenous people, you are definitely better off to consult with them, meet them, make friends, and then they will be able to feed you information at your level that'll make whatever it is you're doing a whole lot richer. So I find this today when I go out into Arnhem Land, if I'm taking, say, a film crew out to film some aspect of natural history, I'll start with the traditional owners, wherever they are, go and sit down with them, tell them what we're thinking of doing, and they just make the whole process so much richer because they know it and they can feed you with their traditional information. That brings it alive for me. Otherwise, it's just science. It's just a job or whatever. I think we can make our lives so much richer by linking up with traditional owners wherever we are.
Absolutely. So from Chloe Stevo asked, what did you study?
Well, initially I was very interested in zoology. As a kid, I loved animals. I had pet tiger snakes and death adders and things that I could nurse. And I found out that, you know, a lot of the things in this world that we are scared of as modern humans actually have personalities that can relate to humans. And since then, I've been working with crocodiles, saltwater crocodiles. 5-meter crocodiles can come in and get to know you and not want to eat you. So it sounds weird, but I believe, as Aboriginal people do, that you can relate to all these different animals, and fear only ruins us. If we're scared, we never learn of the personalities of the animals that we're interested in. And that doesn't mean you do dumb things with crocodiles and venomous snakes or anything. It just means that there's more to it than we think, and fear will stop us from having a good relationship with things. And so that's one thing that I've really, really enjoyed learning from Aboriginal people and myself. And they taught me how to relate to animals in a different way. But going back to my training, I realised that, well, when I finished doing zoology, a couple of my Aboriginal mates said to me, so what did they teach you about animals? And I explained a little bit about how I learned about vertebrate zoology and how it all works and marsupials. And they said, well, what will they teach you about plants? I said, oh, no, they didn't teach us about plants. This is zoology. And they said, well, it's not much good learning about animals if you don't understand plants. Mm. And I thought, yeah, they're right. It is not much good.
Interconnected, isn't
it? And I said, all right, you've got to teach me. And they spent about the next 10 years explaining all the relationships. Every animal has a whole range of plants that it's dependent on one way or another and so on. And then you realise that the saltwater crocodile doesn't interact with plants, doesn't eat plants, but it needs plants. And then you look back through the food chain and you realise all the things that the crocodile eats, the fish feed on algae and aquatic plants and things. And Aboriginal people know all this. They know that plant eventually leads to that crocodile. But we don't have that aspect of science that are looking at ecology in that detail. They do. So, yeah, that's been beneficial to me. So I had to transfer my Western education or mix it with a traditional education. Then it came alive for me.
It's that connectedness, isn't it? Everything's connected.
My word.
So we have a question from, bear with me here, Tristan CB2000, and he or she asks, what is it like to be able to speak those languages, those Indigenous languages?
Well, it's kind of like a doorway. If you can sit and listen to an old man talking away about a particular subject, particularly something that's no longer available, in his own language, he's comfortable, he's relaxed, and you get a real insight into what it is that he's talking about. If he's got to translate it into English for me, I know I'm only going to get a small percentage of what he's really trying to say. And that has been our problem in Australia for the last 250 years. We really aren't that good at translating. But the Aboriginal languages are very... they're not difficult. They're systematic, more than English. And I found learning these languages was exciting. It wasn't just something I had to do. It was giving me a whole new doorway into other people's minds. So I encourage anybody who is able to do that. And by the way, the language that I learned first, Jambarpoyngo language, it's available now at university. You can do it online. It's far better face-to-face, but you can do all the principles first and then come up and meet the people who speak it later. So there are ways of doing that today.
And it's largely phonetic, I would think.
Very phonetic, completely phonetic, yes. Okay. And they have a phonetic alphabet which works perfectly. So once you get on the track, you can work out... By hearing a word spoken, you can write it down correctly. You can't do that with English.
No, I agree.
English doesn't work that way.
And it's got all sorts of rules and exceptions to the rules, so yes.
Exceptions to the rules, definitely.
Yeah. Next question comes from Kristen of Earth, and she asks, what were your interests as a child?
Well, it began very early. I started to have a fascination for plants and animals, and my poor mother, who was a suburban lady from Sydney and had no experience with nature outside of her sort of inner Sydney suburb, she was horrified to think she'd just given birth to a child that had all these passions that she didn't sort of know about. And next door to our property in Sydney was a horse, was being adjusted on a vacant block. And my mother kept losing me. I kept crawling out the door before I could walk. And one day she lost me and she ran around all over the place and she realised I was next door and I was under this horse, in the shade of a horse. And she was terrified of the horse. And when the horse moved, I moved underneath and I stayed underneath the horse. And she eventually had to ring my father at work to get him to come and rescue me. And he arrived home and roared laughing. But I just found the company of the horse was great. I can just remember that. And then there are more and more stories. She told me, look, you can have animals as pets, but you're not allowed to bring home snakes. And I thought, I wonder what's wrong with snakes. So I went down the bush and found one, and I brought it home, to her horror. I mean, that's how my childhood started. I had this great passion for animals mainly at that stage.
Oh, it sounds fantastic. I could just imagine your mother's face when you brought a snake home. I can imagine the horror on her face. Oh, my goodness.
We ended up taming all the possums in the neighbourhood so that they could all come and get patted and get a piece of bread and jam or something. And the birds would come down in flocks and into our back suburban backyard and things. And I realised, you know, we had the ability to relate to these things, and that still excites me.
It sounds a little like Dr. Doolittle, yeah? The animal whisperer. I suppose it segues nicely into the next question from Appreciating Every Presence. And you'll have to excuse my pronunciation of the name of the python, but Appreciating Every Presence asks, have you ever seen the Oenpelli python? Is that the right pronunciation, or am I?
Indeed.
Yep.
Oenpelli python. It's Gunwingal name is Nowarun. Nowarun. And Nowarun is a very secretive, it could be Australia's longest snake. At the moment, the scrub python or amethystine python of Cape York is credited with being our longest snake that goes up to 7 metres plus. Well, this is a very similar snake to that. And the Aboriginal people in Arnhem Land, West Arnhem, where it lives, they tell me that it does get over 7 metres. So it could well be Australia's biggest snake, but it's so secretive and nobody knows much about it. Now, I was very lucky because occasionally I would come across one crossing a road in Kakadu, and I would very carefully, because I was scared of snakes on the road getting run over, so I'd load it into my vehicle and drive it to the community of Gunbalenya or Oenpelli, and there was an old lady. And that snake was her dreaming. And I would say to her, I've got another one in the back of the car, another Nowarun. And she would hop in and we would drive it out about another 30 kilometres to the dreaming site for that snake. And we would let it go away from the roads where it would get run over. So I did that, I think, probably half a dozen times with very large Oenpelli pythons. Today, they're very, very rare. We don't know quite why they're so rare, but their numbers certainly have gone down. And a very good friend of mine is now breeding them here in Darwin to supply zoos and wildlife parks and things so people can learn about them and appreciate them. But they are one of our rarest snakes.
Last question. And it comes from Liz E. 11. What is the best way to support Indigenous communities?
Well, good question. I think the best way to support Indigenous communities is to personalise it. So go there to start with. And whoever you are and whatever age you are, you'll meet people who want to meet you and you'll make friends. They're very interpersonal people. And when Aboriginal people establish a friendship, they expect it to be lifelong, not just how you're going and I live in Southern Australia and see you later, which is the sort of people we are. They are more closely linked with each other and therefore any Europeans and outside people who want to join in and become closely linked really get an amazing benefit. So you can support Aboriginal communities in many ways, but I think firstly make some friends in that community. Then you'll find out ways that you can help. You can, I mean, I use my money to help Indigenous kids get an education that's not accessible to them where they are. So there are ways of improving their access to education, the sort of education they like and they want. So I have a lot of fun doing that sort of thing. Health. There's lots of ways you can help communities, community health, supporting them. It depends who you are and what your skills are. But I just know from being attached to these communities all my life that they really appreciate friends elsewhere who are good friends and who can help them in a practical way. And they can help you back too. I mean, they'll make you just as happy as you'll make them. But it's an interpersonal thing. So get personally involved. And then you can support them in all sorts of ways that you have access to that they may not. without going into all those details.
Well, that sounds like it's a wonderful way to start for sure. So Ian, thank you very much for your time today. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you and having a little dip into the life, your fascinating life up in Arnhem Land. I hope that someday soon you will come back and join us again on Talking Australia.
Be my pleasure.
That's it for today's episode of Talking Australia. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email, podcast@australiangeographic.com, or find us on Instagram @AustralianGeographic. And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia, you'll find a special subscription offer. So don't wait. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Thanks for listening, and hear you next time.